Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Fresh from Broadway, the Tony Award-winning musical Fun Home is now playing at the Fox. We'll have more on that just a little bit later. Also coming to us from New York for a St. Louis visit is Amy Harmon, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning national correspondent for The New York Times. She's in town for an engagement this evening at the Plant Science Center. Science is her thing, as she reports on science and society, the impact of one on the other. We're happy to welcome Amy to the studio. So nice to have you here.
It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I know you got off to a very early start today, so I'll make it easy on you today.
Thank you,
Amy.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people in the science community are a little concerned these days because we're going to have a new administration that so far has shown signs of not believing in some of the things that scientists do, like climate change. Are you concerned about what may be ahead?
I am concerned. I've heard. I think it's some parts of science are still unclear how the administration is going to go. You know, we're waiting to hear who the Health and Human Services head is going to be. Newt Gingrich is said to be a big supporter of biomedical science, so I know there are a lot of scientists out there sort of hoping that he will be an ally. He's supposed to be an advisor to the administration. But for climate change, the scientists that I know are pretty much wringing their hands. I mean, you know, Donald Trump has said that he thinks that climate change is a hoax. He has appointed Myron Ebel, who's a well-known climate denier, a denier of sort of the overwhelming scientific consensus that humans are causing climate change, to be the head of the transition of the EPA. So there is a lot of concern out there.
Well, the transition of the EPA may not be if things continue on their current course.
He has also said that he wants to dismantle the EPA. So there's, I think, a big scramble going on now among people, you know, environmentalists, activists, not just environmentalists and activists, but sort of, you know, the companies who have sort of started down the road on what was agreed to in Paris to manage their emissions, are also speaking out. We had a story in our paper, I didn't write it, but, you know, the other day, about how companies are actually urging Trump not to withdraw from the Paris Agreement.
Which he has
said he is going to do.
All right. Well, so what if these things all happen?
Well, it's not clear how much. So, you know, one thing that I have heard is that, you know, many companies have announced that they're going to voluntarily comply with Paris anyway, because they have decided, you know, it was a complicated negotiation, but it's basically in their best interest in the long run to do it.
Basically, turn back emissions. We were going to cut back to very dramatically on emissions.
Yes.
By 2020, I guess it is, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
So that it, yes, because otherwise, I mean, but, you know, so on the one hand, you could see different forces. There's also just the force of the economy that, you know, Donald Trump has said he really wants to reinvigorate the coal industry. But if there's not demand for coal as overseas, that's not going to necessarily be able to happen whether he wants to or not. So, however, you know, he could have a big impact. And there were scientists out there saying that this is, you know, 4 years. These are a crucial 4 years, right? So Paris is already, a lot of people think Paris, what we agreed to in Paris, isn't enough, and that it was really going to take, you know, big efforts by the U.S. to make sure that everyone complies and to be a leader and to sort of get everyone on board. So if that's already not enough and we're pulling back from it and this is a crucial 4 years, we're going to get over the limit and you know, it could be a disaster for our children.
Well, you know, and for places like Miami, for instance.
Yes.
On the other hand, you must be, in a sense, licking your chops because it's going to really keep you busy if these things unfold as they might.
Well, as a reporter, yes, there's a lot of stories out there to write. I think that, you know, the other thing I guess I should say is that states, I mentioned, you know, sort of voluntary compliance among industry, but states can play a big role in and already do play a really big role in carrying out these regulations and local. So I think that it kind of brings climate coverage, reporting, and also, activism to that extent, back to a more local level, which I think is going to be interesting to cover. I think issues of environmental justice. I mean, if you have an EPA, lots of people don't think the EPA does its job anyway, so you've got to cover that. But if there's not even an EPA, then I think issues of environmental justice become more and more important. That's something that I'm really looking forward to digging into.
Do you think it's realistic to believe that an enterprise as large as the Environmental Protection Agency could be just disbanded?
I guess I'm not an expert on that, but that is what he has declared over and over. Right? We heard that throughout the campaign.
Sure.
I mean, that was one of his big things. On the other hand, he's also rolling back, some of his other big campaign. I mean, I don't know if he, to the extent that this wall that he promised is really going to be built, or to the extent that, the immigrants that he said that he would kick out of the country are going to be. It's not exactly clear how much he's following through on everything. I kind of suspect that dismantling the EPA, though, is one of those things that he seems to intend to do.
Right. I don't want to sound like Donald Rumsfeld, but I guess we don't know what we don't know with regard to all of this yet.
A lot of it is speculation. One thing I do know, I'll just put it in a picture there, because you mentioned, as a reporter, kind of licking your chops, but the New York Times has 41,000 new subscribers since the election. I just saw a press release came out this morning, because one reason that's relevant is that because he actually has tweeted, I think, that we were losing subscribers. The failing New York Times is losing subscribers, but I think they wanted to set the record straight on that.
Maybe it's only because he's probably canceled his subscription.
He seems to read us very regularly, though. He has something to say every morning.
Yeah. Just as an aside, away from your beat for just a moment, he seems to be intent on maintaining this kind of breach between himself, his administration, incoming administration, and the media, particularly newspapers. I mean, there's a disturbing element to this. He's not taking pool people with him. He's just kind of – he goes off to 21 Club for a $36 hamburger, and ditches the press group supposed to be following him.
Right, and when he went to visit President Obama for the first time, he just decided not to take reporters with him. I think that is a real concern. I think that night that he went out to dinner, the pool was told, oh, he's not going to be leaving the building, and then however long after that they found out that he did, they had to chase him downtown. He it's interesting because he loves Twitter so much. He sort of seems to be, in a way, really out there and accessible, but he does seem to be wanting to evade coverage.
That seems to be the way he is going to prefer to communicate, is through Twitter.
It's not clear. He at some point he said he was going to cut back on Twitter, but he seems to be drawn to it as a means of expression.
Right. What's the buzz around the paper with regard to all of this?
I think we're all looking forward to, the publisher sent out, the publisher, Arthur Sulzberger and Dean Baquet, the editor of The Times, sent out a letter among the whole staff saying, sort of rallying us and saying, look, this is what we were founded for. We were founded to cover without fear or favor, to report on what is out there. And this is a really important time. And they warned us to, this is right after the election. They said, get a good rest this weekend because we have a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're gearing up for that.
Yeah, well, it's not only Donald Trump and some of the people around him who are suspicious, if that's the right word, of journalists these days. Apparently a huge block of people in this country feel the same way and are not enamored of this profession that you and I are in.
I think that's true. I think increasingly people are getting their news from these very narrow windows of social media, which has been something that has been brought up as one reason why many of us were surprised that Trump did win the election, because we were sort of all, in the same echo chamber of our own, narrow Facebook feeds. I think there's another concern is fake news.
Exactly.
When I first saw the reports of that, I sort of dismissed it because I feel like I see fake news and I know it right away. I don't I don't pay attention to it. Certainly with reporting on GMOs, you see a lot of sort of scary fear-mongering stuff that circulates. And so since I had been doing that for the last couple of years, I thought, oh, but people, I mean, there's a report out, I think it was today, that said that, you know, fake news, people believe it. People believe it. And that those stories performed much that got more clicks, essentially, than real news during the election cycle.
Headlines like the Pope endorses Donald Trump for president and things like that. I mean, there are scores of them that you could point to.
There was one just yesterday, I think, about David Brooks, a New York Times columnist, mm-hmm. Who had written, I think at the end of one of his columns, he wrote something like, well, this guy will probably be impeached within the first year, so don't worry about it. And they had added the word assassinated. They said, like, and they had put in a headline that David Brooks said that Trump will be impeached or assassinated. And it's just crazy. I mean, because that's such an inflammatory thing. I don't think he would ever have said that. So, but that was being circulated everywhere as though this was true.
Does this whole social media thing fall under your umbrella in your beat?
In my beat, yes, I think there's science. Twitter is a formidable force. I think anytime you have a science story, there's stuff out there. I mean, but certainly the stories that I wrote about genetic engineering, there are strong, you know, camps that feel very strongly both ways about genetic engineering, and I hear from them whenever I write something on Twitter. I've been photoshopped on Facebook by a group that felt that I was too sympathetic to the industry. In a story that I wrote about Hawaii a couple of years ago, where the big island of Hawaii was thinking about banning cultivation of all GMOs. And I wrote about a county council man who kind of his journey into trying to understand that issue and how to vote on it, which, you know, I don't think that, you know, it wasn't one way or another. It wasn't slanted one way or another. It was simply reporting what he actually went through. But I got some ugly Facebook.
Well, if you have
comments.
Any questions about it, Monsanto is only a few miles down the road.
I didn't realize quite how close I was actually when I was coming to the Danforth Center.
Yeah, I know. They're a big presence here. What got you into this particular beat, the interest in science? Is this a lifelong thing?
Well, you know, it's not. I didn't study science in school, although I wish I had. I am an American Studies major, mm-hmm. graduate of the University of Michigan. But I actually started out just as a reporter in the. I'll date myself here, but in the early 90s, covering the internet, sort of the rise of the internet. It didn't really exist as a social and cultural force. It was just starting to do when I.
Al Gore hadn't invented it yet.
Exactly. but so I wasn't by any means a technology person, and I wasn't. There were a lot of people writing about technology and business, but I wanted to write about kind of the social impact that it was having. And then when I felt like everyone else had started to write about the social impact of technology, I got really interested in science and switching to writing about the social impact of science, because I think we often cover science through the lens of, like, the latest research. It's an important lens. I mean, we have the Science Times and the New York Times every week. We do have stories on what is, like, the most important story in scientific journals that week. But I was more interested in writing about how it impacts people, and also in finding stories, like ways to talk about science that might draw people in who are not necessarily turning to the Science Times.
And that's a big issue in this country today. I mean, there really seems to be a pulling back from the STEM disciplines, if you will. And it's a real issue, as you well know, because other people are surpassing us. Countries you might not expect to be doing as much and doing as well are surpassing us this year.
I think I'm actually working now on a story that is related to science education and math education, and beyond just sort of, you know, making us competitive, making the realm of science more representative of who Americans are, because that's another, I think, big issue in science, is that there are very few minorities in science. There are many fewer women than there should be. And I think that you know, who does our science really impacts on the kind of science that gets done, and just on sort of social equality in general, because we spend a lot of money. We spend tens of billions of dollars as a country on taxpayer-funded science, and that money should be distributed fairly.
Sure. We can get back and talk more about that. I have to take a break. Another thought just comes to me as we talk about this, though, is the fact that we're bringing a lot of people with the science backgrounds from other countries. Here we need them, and we're relying on them in many cases. But again, if things go as some people suspect they might, it's going to be more difficult to get some of these people from other countries this country.
That's very true.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Amy Harmon. She is appearing tonight at the 8 p.m., or 6 p.m., I should say, at the Danforth Planned Science Center. Her talk is titled, Let's Talk About Technology, Truth, and the Public. Again, that's at 6 o'clock at the Danforth Planned Science Center. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Amy, you mentioned a moment ago the kind of inequity in racial groups participating in science. Why is that? What's going on?
Well, there are a lot of different reasons for it. So one that I'm looking at now, and is, I haven't published this story yet, but I'm interested in sort of tracing it back even to sort of math in middle school. I mean, you know, I think math, there's one statistic that the National Science Foundation collects these statistics about, you know, who gets PhDs in math and physics. And the number of African-Americans who got a PhD in math in 2014 is 2.7, there are 27 total PhDs for African Americans in math in 2014 from U.S. Degree granting institutions, and then you know the numbers for physics are pretty low too. Biology is somewhat better, mm-hmm. but to me, you know, it goes back to the really deeply unequal education system that we have. And beyond that, I've actually been looking at sort of advanced math. There's kind of this whole subculture of advanced math programs where people are, even if you're doing really well in school, it might be hard for you to get into an elite college because you haven't done this enrichment math, mm-hmm. which is now sort of all the vogue. And so it's like, it's, you know, there's people talk about the achievement gap in schools, and now there's this enrichment gap, which is, I think, causing problems down the line. There's also more basic things like, you know, the cost of college is expensive, and so and since there's a strong link between class and race, that we're going to see less of blacks and Latinos.
Are you suggesting, among other things, that maybe the schools and the in inner city schools, for instance, are not really doing their job and getting these young African Americans, for instance, interested in these disciplines?
I think they're interested. I think that they're. I think you know there are studies that are done that show that either, you know, there's not any lack of interest or difference in interest among, you know, white and Asian and black and Latino kids in math and science. And so the question is, are they being, you know, do they have the opportunity to learn it, to get the skills, you know, enough to pursue it in mm-hmm. college? And I think that is what is not happening. And it has to do with, you know, lack of an unequal distribution of resources.
That might include teachers. One of the things, we've talked about this whole STEM issue a number of times on this program, and one of the things that keeps popping up is there aren't as many science teachers out there as maybe there should be, because a lot of the people who have those qualifications, those aptitudes, are going to Google and Facebook and some of the things we talked about earlier.
Yes, I think that it's absolutely true that we don't reward our teachers the way they should be rewarded, and so there's not as much of an incentive for somebody to go teach middle school math if you have a math PhD. But it would be nice if that was happening more. In Eastern European countries, there's a whole tradition of college professors teaching math to high school students, and we don't have that here.
A lot of kids are afraid of math for some reason. I figure that's just too hard.
That is also something that gets kind of ingrained quite early. And I think that, you know, there's also an argument there's now being made that you know, not everyone has to learn all that math. And that may be true. But I think that, you know, one of the things I'm interested in is if you have gifted, you know, if there are children that are gifted at math, but they're not, you know, they're passed over for gifted programs, that which happens, as there's been lots of studies to show that sort of Blacks and Latino kids are not getting into these programs. That's a problem.
Well, one of the things you hear is, well, algebra. You know, once I graduated from high school, I never had an algebraic formula come across my desk ever. So why do I need to learn that stuff? But it's more of an exercise for the brain, isn't it?
There is that. I mean, you know, people who think that, I mean, it's true that math is really, you know, in a way, an art form. Once you get past algebra, you just have to get past. There are some gateway classes. Calculus also in college has been shown to be, you know, men and women do sort of equally well in these classes, but women perceive themselves as doing less well. So they give up after calculus.
Of course, the problem with getting past algebra is that calculus and trigonometry
are
waiting for you. And that's by the so why are women less inclined in this area, less inclined to partake of the sciences?
Well, again, I wouldn't say they're less inclined. I think in terms of interest, if you, you know, do studies at a, you know, among younger students, you find equal interest. And so one of the interesting things about this calculus study, and I'm blanking on the author right now, but was that it was more of an issue of self-perception, not a degree of self-confidence in thinking, well, you know, this is really hard and maybe I got a B minus, but I can still be very successful. And women just don't have that. That's a socialized question. What there was also a recent study about women 12 years. There's a standardized test that's given to 12-year-olds. That's like above their level, but it's given every year to 12-year-olds. And girls have been at the top, have always been less than boys. And so that's given rise to this, you know, reinforces this belief that boys are somehow naturally better at math. But this recent study showed that over time, and in 2010, I think, that gap was closing substantially. So it sort of makes you realize that it's not something innate. It's because, you know, over the last 20 years, girls have been encouraged to do math and to feel that they can do math. Also, if you compare it internationally and you look, they looked at India versus the U.S., where in India, you know, girls are not encouraged to think that they are, you know, able to advance that way. There are, the numbers at the top are much lower, but that's not because Indian girls are less confident than you. It's just it's a socialized thing. It's not any
other things.
Yes.
Let's take a couple of calls. If you're game, we'll we'll start with Scott calling from Chesterfield on this subject of education. Scott, come on in. You're on the air with Amy Harmon.
Yeah. Education is crucial, but a recent study in the Washington Post said that Blacks and whites who have the same education level, whites make more income. And also there was a study by Young Invincibles which said that young blacks had to have two levels higher of education to get the same jobs as their white counterparts. But I guess the good news is that the new president has promised a new deal for Black America.
All right. Thank you for the call. Any comment to...
Well, first of all, he reads the Washington Post, so I don't know if I can even answer this. But I'm not sure what the caller... I mean, certainly there's... I didn't get to that in terms of, you know, all of the factors that go into why there are, minorities are underrepresented in science. Just hiring discrimination is certainly one of them. So, you know, in certain fields, especially biology, I know that there are, you know, there are plentiful candidates, and there is evidence of just discrimination, what you've just described. I'm not totally sure what you mean about the new deal for blacks that Donald Trump has promised.
Nor am I. I can't quite figure that out. He's no longer there, I don't believe. Okay, well, in any case.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Do you want to say?
I mean, I think that there is a lot of concern among the black community about some of the comments that Donald Trump has made about inner cities being like hellscapes, and I think that there's a real concern about how he does intend to deal with issues of social equality.
Well, we're going through a situation here at one of our high schools in which black students have been have been insulted, racist comments made against them, one even burned. And the blame is being placed on people who feel emboldened and entitled through some of the comments from Mr. Trump.
There has been a real uptick. We've reported on that too, a colleague of mine, a real uptick in racist speech and incidents since the election that's of concern. And, there are groups that have called on him to sort of denounce it. He kind of gave a nod to it in a 60 Minutes interview and said he was saddened by it, but there hasn't been really a strong statement from the administration about that.
Time is beginning to wind down. I'd like to bring in one more caller. George is calling from the Lafayette Square neighborhood. George, come on in, but make it quick, please.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to make a really quick comment. You made a comment about how a lot of our students that are in the secondary school system are international students. I want to talk to that because I was in the electrical engineering program at my alma mater, and it was not only a predominant student body of Middle Eastern and Pakistani and Indian students, but the department as well, the facilitators, the teachers, were also predominantly Persian. And the other thing I wanted to ask was for your guest to clarify on the distribution of money for science research, because I would have to say that not all science research is created equal. You know, you got somebody that's doing a lot of really hardcore research on electromagnetism and its effects on, you know, some particular hardware or electronics and stuff like that, and you have like another person that says, I'm going to look at the effects of like organic foods on people's ability to judge the quality of food or something like that. And another thing
get,
I wanted
get
to
the
say
point
was,
we're running out of time. We really need we
okay,
need
really
a question
quick,
mark.
I just wanted to also make a point on the fact that it's two things that I think affects people when it comes to mathematics: initial conditions, meaning where they come from, socially and race-wise. And the second was the standardization that is in the secondary school system that creates a lot of stigmas about the mathematical topics and sciences. That's
okay,
it.
George, thank you. That way, way too long, by the way. Amy's got 30 seconds to respond.
There's
to all
a lot
of that.
There. I guess I'll just answer the thing that he asked me to clarify, which is that when I said that research money for research should be equally distributed, I just meant that there's something intrinsically unfair about the idea that we're spending as a public all this money on research and yet we're not educating underrepresented minorities to the point where they can partake of that research funding.
I wish we had more time. There's a lot to talk about, but
yes.
We'll be reading you, and a lot of people will be listening to you tonight. Amy Harmon is appearing this evening at 6 o'clock at the Danforth Plan Science Center. Her talk is titled, Let's Talk About Technology, Truth, and the Public. Thank you so much
Thank
for being
you for
with
having
us.
Me.
Enjoy your time here in St. Louis. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.